Hello, this is Daniel Chalkett.
And this is Manton Reese.
And this is Core Intuition, an element of academicness. Manton, I know you are in love with your iPhone 4C, but does it have an unbreakable, unscratchable, a bendable glass face?
It doesn't have the new fancy glass. It has the old-fashioned glass, whatever's on the 5C. But it's pretty durable. It's pretty unscratchable. The thing about my phone now, and I think I've mentioned this before, is, I mean, we all get new phones every couple of years or year for everyone who's obsessed about getting the latest one. It doesn't bother me if it has scratches on it anymore. I don't use a case. I drop it sometimes. I do not want the screen to break.
Right.
That's the thing I don't want. Little scratches here and there. It's fine. But no, so there's this new rumor. Maybe it's more than a rumor, right? There's actual leaked pieces of the iPhone 6 starting to show up.
I'm not savvy enough to know how to evaluate the legitimacy of these things because, yeah, everyone's point. I guess my naive way of evaluating it is like people who seem to be reputable are linking to it. So I'm right. Like, okay. but it's one of those things where it's like, okay, this thing looks like. The demo, which we'll link to, is like some guy who claims he has a leaked component from iPhone 6, confirming not only that it's like a slightly larger screen than the current iPhone, but the screen is this new, well, I guess it's existed, but it's made entirely of sapphire glass, so-called sapphire glass. It's a brand of glass that is apparently virtually indestructible, and the demo shows this glass with, you know, keys, not just a key, but like keys, a knife, like different things being taken to it, seemingly with no effect on the glass. And
because I keep an open knife in my pocket sometimes with my phone.
Right.
That's great, though. And my first thought when I saw the video, so like the poster frame, kind of like the still version of the video, like I thought there was no glass in me. Did you think that? Like it was so clear. And, you know, his hand is through the other side or something.
I thought it was just like a frame.
I thought it was just a frame. So that's a good sign, I think.
Yeah. Here's how it works with Apple stuff, I think. We are very, so satisfied with the fact that it works so much better than expected that unless we get sort of like tuned into a defect or a shortcoming, then we're liable to just overlook things that in retrospect we will eventually all agree were like the way they should have done it all along, right? And this is the story of the iPhone in particular since day one. It's like, oh, this thing's amazing. Who cares that you can't copy and paste, right?
Yeah.
Like that's not even important. And now it's like, can you imagine not having copy and paste? And I think if you take a step back and you imagine like, a world where there's no constraints, where physical materials exist that basically I don't understand. Of course, I want a phone to be something that can jostle around in my pocket with knives and keys and not receive a single scratch. And that's the reason we don't expect that, I think, is because it doesn't seem possible to my naive, you know, material sciences ignorant brain. Yep. But if they can make something like that, and Apple seems like the company that would choose to do that, probably ahead of all the other ones, if they can make that leap in like raising the standard, then I think we'll all look back and think, oh my God, can you believe we used to have to take care of our phones?
Right.
Like we used to have to coddle our phones. Like we had, remember when we had a reserved pocket for our phone? Or remember when everybody, you know, bought cases, not everybody, obviously, but
that would be great. Can you imagine 5-10 years from now if the case market doesn't, I mean, it's hard to imagine and it doesn't seem possible because cases also are kind of a fashion statement, but I personally hate cases.
Me
I never
too.
Use them anymore. And I would love to see cases not be quite as commonplace as they used to be.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes cases, I don't know. So my latest story with my daughters is last week, one of my daughters accidentally dropped her phone with a case in a bowl of salsa. and it kind of floated there at the top, which I think saved it.
Oh, my.
It just, like, half submerged. And we did the quick, like, clean off, power down, quick. Okay, quick, where's the bowl of rice? Put it in the rice, quick, you know. Put it in the rice.
Oh, in the dry hours. In the dry rice, right?
Right. Yeah. Seal it up. And it was fine.
Does it smell like, does it have a south of the border right scent?
It was fine. Mostly there was something stuck in the headphone jack that was confusing it a little bit. And we actually went to an Apple store and they have little tools that can clean that stuff out real quick.
Nice.
And, so it's totally back to normal. But anyway, sometimes a case, you know, protects it a little more.
Yep.
For those falling in food and water moments.
Yeah, it just goes to show how large you live life in Texas, that you have a bowl of salsa big enough to hold not only salsa, but an entire phone that can float on the surface. This is like the salsa sea.
Pretty much, yeah. It's just kind of half submerged. And you know, it was thick salsa, right? So it's not like dropping in water. It's not quite as bad.
It's like her phone was the miracle phone. It could walk on salsa.
Right. So the other thing about this leak component is that as you said, it's bigger. And we haven't seen, you know, we didn't see two leak components, one that's the normal size and one that's bigger. And I still think that they're going to have multiple sizes. This is based on just what I want, not any actual fact or anything. I cannot see them shipping a new phone with a bigger size and already scrapping the 4-inch phone, which isn't really that old.
I know. I like to believe what you say is true, Manton, but who knows? You know, it would have been easy to say, I think, that when they introduced this current like iPhone 5 case, remember this? Like, I was among the people who was like whining and fretting and hemming and hawing about the fact that now my phone sticks out of my pocket and it's too big and it's too long. And I honest to God, cannot even imagine. I have zero complaints about the size of my phone now. Like, it was just a sensory, you know, difference.
Well, and I hated the new size so much, I stuck with the 4S for an extra year after everyone else had long moved on and gotten used to the 5. But again, I still think the 4S is nearly perfect in design. Yeah. But
what about the 5 size now? You're okay?
Yeah, I'm
with
totally
that?
Used to it. I was used to it very quickly. And if I had to go back to the 4S, despite how perfect I thought it was, it would be in another adjustment period. And maybe I wouldn't be able to. Because the screen, new screen, I mean, the taller screen is nice. You're reading something. I mean, it is handy.
Yeah.
But just as a developer, I'm not saying that the bigger screen will need many tweaks for apps. But it's just another thing to kind of transition to and embrace. And it's a good thing. We should be using auto layout. We should be thinking about, in my opinion, universal apps that work great on the phone, great on the iPad, resize nicely to different sizes. But just having, I don't know, just having so many different screen sizes and not having the consistency that we're used to will kind of bum me out a little bit.
Yeah, I think I'm fully sold now on the idea that that old original iPhone fixed screen size and then the minor variation. I think I'm sort of sold on the idea that we're going to see a whole lot of different iOS screen sizes in the future and sort of like whereas. You know, like when the Retina phones first came out, it was like a really safe bet to assume they would just be, you know, whatever, double the resolution, quadruple the pixels. It was easy to make that guess then because those of us who knew Apple were like, you know, it's important that the dimensions of the screen stay the same. And I don't think you can make that bet these days anymore. And yeah, part of it's because auto layout's there and it makes it a lot easier. You know, stuff they announced at WWDC indicates that they're moving towards an even less predictable screen resolution for these platforms.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm not uptight about that anymore. And that's a good example of something where I would have been fretting. I was fretting, actually, when the iPhone 5 came out. Because what was that? That was like, what was it, something like 40, 60 extra pixels or something, or, you know, points in the vertical. I don't know what it is, but it was something off. And I thought, oh, God. And I had to, you know, adapt to it. Like in my one iOS app in Shush, I had to make the TV screen longer on you know, an iPhone 5, and I thought, this is just too much. Like, oh,
this that's is great though. You're in your app. You could have easily abandoned that app and not, you know, it's not a huge money maker. A lot of people, you can tell if an app has been updated or not. If it has been updated for some of the new stuff, you know, first Retina, then the new screen size, then iOS 7. So the fact you updated, that's good.
Yeah, well, you know, I am responsible. And also, wouldn't it be funny, Manton, if I was pretending like Shush was this big failure, and then it was like how I paid for my house?
That would be great.
Wouldn't it be great?
It's your big secret. You just don't want anyone else to know. Yeah. Well, so along those lines, though, I was just reading last night a post by Russell Ivanovic, who does Pocket Casts, and he has a blog that we'll link to, but he has this post called The Android Screen Fragmentation Myth, where he kind of debunks the whole argument that was part of what I just said about having to support multiple sizes and how it's actually kind of a no-brainer. It's not that big of a deal at all. There's really, in practice, only a few sizes. And development tools, like you said, make it easier. Yeah. But I don't know if you saw that, but I like that post a lot. And it's not, I guess maybe I said it backwards. Maybe as a developer, you're right. Maybe it's just something that is going to happen. Maybe as a user, I'm the most offended because I don't want a bigger phone. I don't.
Yep.
And I don't, and the developer part is that I don't really want to test on a bigger phone. I don't want to buy a bigger phone. I'll just use the simulator, you know, to test. But I don't like the trend toward bigger phones. I think that, you know, I resisted the slightly bigger, slightly taller phone, and I'm definitely going to completely resist the giant. It's almost an iPad size.
Yeah, I have to hope that in a company like Apple, there are enough influential people who share our affinity for the quote-unquote classic size. And I count the iPhone 5 because it is a relatively minor change in form factor from the original iPhone and iPhone 4. I count that as the classic size. You know, it's like if we're comparing it to like MacBooks, it's like the MacBook, it's like the 12-inch MacBook becomes the 13-inch MacBook. Right. And like, it's going to annoy some people who are just in love with that 1-inch smaller profile, right. But it's still the same class of device. And so, if we think about it that way, in MacBooks, it used to be like, you know, 13-inch, 15-inch, 17-inch. And I'm okay with those. I'm okay with, for instance, having, I think Apple can get away with having three sort of size classes to borrow a term. A phone, but out of respect for almost I know it's funny saying this because I know Apple doesn't really give a damn about respecting the origins. You know, they love to kill their old products, right? They're not making a fancy new iPod every year out of respect for the product that, you know, probably saved the company in some respect. So I don't know. They could easily just jump ship and say, sorry, that iPhone original form factor was part of the process, part of the evolution that led us to the perfect size, which is what, 4.3 inches. What are they calling it? This new unbreakable glass phone.
I don't even know. I heard over four and I started.
You started crying. You started rubbing salsa in your eyes.
Do you know how big a salsa bowl I need to support that kind of phone being dropped in it?
There's that old country song, there's a tear in my salsa.
The other possibility is I kind of wonder sometimes if – so maybe the iPhone 6 is new and big. And maybe they keep the 5C and the 5S around at their current sizes and their current speeds and all that because – they're still advertising the 5S heavily. Like it seems like every couple of weeks there's a new ad for the 5S. And we're very close to the 6. And I don't know, I haven't gone back to see if they always heavily introduce new, you know, TV ads like a month or two before a new phone comes out. But I was just kind of struck when I was watching one of the new ones that they're still pushing this in a big way. And I kind of wonder if they'll just keep it around, keep the 5C around too. These are good phones. Yeah. They're fast. They're well-designed. You know, maybe they'll keep those around and maybe the 6 won't have multiple sizes. And then they'll figure it out at, when the 6S or the 7, they'll kind of figure out multiple sizes with one brand.
Yeah, but you know, this is one of those things too, like I know John Gruber has talked a lot about it on the talk show, like the quandary that arises when if the newest, greatest phone is only in a larger form factor, then does that mean that the newest, greatest camera is only in a larger form factor?
Yeah.
And most, well, a lot of us, actually, I can't say most because it's definitely not true, I think, but many of us hold the camera as one of the most important technical features of the hardware, right? Mm-hmm. And it's, especially those of us with kids, I think, or pets probably, it's just nice to be able to take really pretty darn good pictures with your phone. And every time Apple upgrades the phone camera, it's a strong inducement to get the new phone. And if it's going to be this honking 4+ inch thing, it's frankly not as good of a form factor for a convenient little phone that you keep in your pocket.
No, it must make, you know, holding with one hand and having certain situations more difficult.
Yeah.
And that's, like you said, it's a compelling thing. That's my one regret with the 5C is that I don't have the better camera. I don't have the slow motion stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that's my, seriously, that's the one regret. There's nothing else in the 5S that I feel like I'm missing out on. Speed would be great. Fingerprint thing. Yeah. Whatever.
Meh. Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't use a passcode anyway, camera, that's a big deal because you can't go back in time and reshoot video pictures later.
Everybody's going to be pooping your phone next time you're at a conference. Now that we know you don't use a passcode.
What are you going to take it out of my hands?
Oh. I forgot though. It'll only be pooping on app.net. So it won't be a big, zing.
You had to get that in there.
Yeah. Well, this week we are very happy to welcome back as sponsors of the show, Smile, with their PDF Pen 6 for Mac. PDF Pen is a great app. It's kind of a PDF powerhouse for your Mac. If you work with PDFs, you need PDF Pen, the multipurpose PDF editor. PDF Pen can make changes, fix typos, resize images, combine PDFs, and extract pages into a new PDF. It can also perform OCR, that's optical character recognition, that turns your scanned documents into documents that you can easily search as part of a paperless workflow. It can even redact sensitive information by removing it permanently and completely from a PDF. PDF Pen 6 includes Microsoft Word export, an editing bar for faster workflow, Retina graphics, auto-saving, and document versions. PDF Pen 6 is available for $59.95. Visit smilesoftware.com/coreint and see how easily you can edit PDFs with PDF Pen.
Yeah, it's great to have them back sponsoring the podcast. PDF Pen has been around on the Mac for a long time. It's a mature app, version 6. It's great to have around, as I've said before. You know, you have a signature, you can apply it to different documents. If you have contracts or paperwork you have to sign, fill out PDF forms, correct typos. One of the things that I was struck by how powerful PDF Pen is right away. It's like, I don't know about any listener, but I kind of compulsively select things in documents sometimes, like when I'm reading or thinking. And I opened, you know, it was like a AT&T wireless bill. And I just kind of was like accidentally randomly dragging things around. And, you know, in PDF Pen, I can just grab the logo and just move it. I can just actually drag things around and like change the layout and just make changes live to the PDF, which is kind of great. You know, it's like we're used to PDFs being these like static things that you can't change. Well, you can with PDF Pen. You can correct text, you can move stuff around, you can reorganize parts of a document. You want to remove a cover page or some other page in the middle, drag things around. And of course, as they said, Microsoft Word export now, good scanning, OCR. So it's a great app. It's also available for iPad and iPhone. I love the iPad version because I can actually, you know, just use my finger to sign documents or whatnot. So thanks again for sponsoring the show, PDF Pen.
Yeah, you know, Manton, as you know, and as our listeners know, I recently bought a house, and this was one of those situations where I was very happy to have some of PDF Pen's features. I mentioned in the initial read about the redaction feature. And one thing PDF Pen for the Mac does that's so convenient is you can search and replace with redaction. So you can say, for example, search for any occurrence of my social security number and redact it. And this was so handy for like you know, when these banks and so, you know, different credit agencies, whatever, they all want your personal information. And they don't need to have my social security number right on the document. So I was able to just like search for my social security number. And then I would sort of, you know, eyeball that it was catching, it was actually finding, you know, matches for that, and then replace with redaction. And they would just turn to these black squares. It was perfect for that. So just one of the many workflows that PDF Pen for Mac is good for. If you ever deal with PDFs, and let's face it, all of us do, you really owe it to yourself to go check it out. Once again, you can go to smilesoftware.com/coreint for a special landing page welcoming you and speaking to Core Intuition listeners in language that we can clearly understand. And if you do end up checking out and buying PDF Pen, or even if you just want to pass along some compliments about the app, be sure to let them know you heard about it on Core Intuition, because they've been great loyal sponsors of our show this year, and we would love them to know that it's making a difference to get the word out about their products to our listeners. Thanks again, folks. It's smilesoftware.com/coreint. Well, Manton, Apple has been busy at work with a lot of updates to Xcode and, you know, new betas of many pre-release software. Softwares are streaming out of Cupertino at a remarkable pace, in spite of the fact, as we lamented last week, that they will not hire many engineers outside of Cupertino. They seem to have the ones that they possess within those confines working very hard. And one of the things that came out, I feel comfortable mentioning it because it's all over Twitter and people are talking about it publicly, you know, whether that's warranted or not, is they have been making some changes to the Swift programming language. And this is something I think you and I agreed it would be pragmatic to not spend too much time on Swift stuff in the short term, because, well, frankly, we have a hard enough time shipping our updates and new apps with our good old buddy Objective-C.
Yep.
But it was a little vindicating to see that, you know, changes are happening so soon, and I think somewhat substantially, because, you know, they made the disclaimer at WWDC that there would be syntax changes to the language. Mm-hmm. And everybody thought, well, yeah, that's going to be a little annoying because we'll have to change, you know, whatever Swift code we do write. But it's a little vindicating to me. Okay, you know, this thing is really still pretty raw and like new, and I really appreciate all the people out there who are jumping into Swift, you know, head, feet, face first. I don't know, whatever. They're jumping they're floating on Swift like a giant bowl of salsa. That's what they're doing. And they're trying not to sink too far into it.
I'm happy and glad that they're doing that, because I'm not doing that, and someone needs to, not just someone, but 1,000 developers. I mean, people need to be playing with this so that when 1.0 ships, it is great. And Apple certainly needs to not feel afraid to make tweaks so that the language is as good as it can be right out the gate. I agree with you that I'm glad that I have chosen to skip it for now, because, well, for a couple reasons. But before I say that, I will say I haven't totally ignored it. At WWDC week, which is a great kind of, you're not going to get much work done in any way week. Like, I spent a nice afternoon figuring out some Swift. I wrote a little sample app that did some CloudKit stuff. And that was really fun and interesting. I learned some things about the language that maybe are no longer relevant. I'm not sure. And I learned some stuff about the APIs. So I had that experience, and that was good. But yes, I have apps to ship. But the other thing that I keep reading, you know, I'm just following Swift on the kind of the sidelines, but I keep reading things, and man, I'm just not convinced I'm ever going to use it, actually, unless Apple seriously deprecates the old stuff, because it really feels like a two steps forward, one step back, or however you want to, you know, you balance that depending on your feeling about it. Is, I don't know, it's just like I already miss some of the things that I loved about about Objective-C and how dynamic a language it was. And I don't know. I really wish they had done Objective-C without the C. I really wish they had done Objective-C 3.0.
Yeah.
Am I crazy?
Not entirely. I mean, I share some of those feelings, but I don't know how much that's us being the crufty old guys who can't embrace the future.
Yep. And I should say, and that's, it's kind of from going from classic Mac to Coco, I resisted Objective-C a bunch. I'm like, oh, God, we don't need this language. The brackets is crazy. I just give me my C and C++. And and obviously over the years, like, I've totally fallen in love with the language and I love it. And I certainly don't want to be the just, I don't like the new thing.
Right.
But it isn't, I mean, it is a huge change. And I think I'm justified ignoring it right now just from a productivity standpoint. But I also just think it's a big shift in how you write. Maybe not a big shift, but it's a small shift at least in how you think about and write Mac and iOS apps.
There's an element of sort of academicness to it that feels a little less personable to me. For better or for worse, Objective-C with its sort of very noticeable lack of terseness. It's very explicit. It's a long form kind of expressive language. And I guess I've gotten used to that and it feels so simple. And a lot of things I know that drive people crazy, the missing features from Objective-C, well, that's true. There's like, I can't overload operators. I can't, do any manner of like high level thing that, Swift is bringing to the scene, but that just means also with Objective-C, there's that many fewer things to even wrap your head around, right? It's frustrating when you can't do what would be easy in a language with more features. But I mean, once you learn Objective-C, it's kind of like you got that thing as well as you can, at least you have it wrapped around your finger. And I feel like with Swift, there's gonna always be some nuanced feature of Swift that maybe I don't understand or I just don't grasp how to use. And maybe that's the old man too. It's the crufty old guy. Just maybe being a little worried about how well I'm going to be able to adapt to this.
Yeah. I actually think you hit it when you joked about the academicness of it actually. Cause there's certainly a whole new crop of programmers who are very in tune with like languages, arguments about like not having mutable objects and how you deal with, there was a talk at CocoaConf in Austin actually about this, about just dealing with state and designing your apps such that kind of the language itself kind of protects you, or the design of how you're building the app protects you from making these common mistakes. I see it coming up in these new languages. There's the idea of a perfect language that helps prevent problems versus just the practical aspects of, building an app. And I like programming, I guess, but to me, it's just a way to build apps. And I never get caught up in sort of the theory of the language and sort of, I mean, for some people, they love that stuff and that's great. But for me, I just want to build apps, and how quick can I get from my idea and my design to actually shipping an app is what is important to me, not whether the code is perfect or
right.
The design of the app is perfect from an architectural standpoint.
Well, I think the Swift fans out there and the people who are experienced with languages that share more features with Swift are probably thinking to themselves right now, Manton, getting the app written and shipped quickly is what a higher, level language like this is all about. And I think that they are coming at this from a point of view of being familiar with programming idioms that are only possible in these, or not only possible, but are much easier in these languages, and thinking, I'm going to be able to write half the code in half the time and ship, Clipstart competitor.
I don't think that's true with Swift though. I don't think it's half the code. I mean, it's, and in some cases it's more code. I mean, I think the fact that we've lost this sort of, I think, brilliant feature of Objective-C where you can, message nil and you can send messages to objects that don't quite expect them sometimes. That, I think, reduced a lot of code. And I think, Swift, I think that it's actually introduced a lot of overhead for this idea about whether something, the whole optional thing. And that actually seems to introduce code or introduce syntax to me. And maybe it's a temporary thing, but it feels when you're working in Swift and you're dealing with traditional Mac or iOS frameworks that were written in Objective-C, it doesn't feel like less code to me.
Well, here's the high level problem I see is, like you said, it's not Objective-C 3.0. It's Swift. It's an all new language. It's a very ambitious language. It is destined, even with improvements over time, to leave not only within Apple but outside of Apple. The entire Apple development, you know, scene is going to be left somewhat divided about their feelings about it. And what that means, I think the problem is now we've got a situation where right now, starting at the moment that, you know, Swift 1.0 or whatever, the first public release is available, moving forward, we're going to have this situation where we have a platform divided over two languages. And that's not helpful, really. It's not a healthy environment for collaboration, for education. Just from the education point of view, you're going to have some people who insist you should still be teaching everybody to program in Objective-C. Some people are going to be insisting you should teach everybody to program in Swift. Mm-hmm. And you're going to end up with people who completely rightfully claim to be experienced developers for the platform, but know completely different languages.
Yeah.
I'm not saying this, it may be a necessary cost of this transition, but there's something to the complete, you know, change of course with Swift, as like you said, not just continuing to build upon Objective-C. There's something about the completeness of the turn that is going to make it a little rough for a little while, and maybe a long while, actually. You know, imagine 5 years from now, and especially if we've got frameworks at Apple that still sort of exhibit behaviors that are that reflect its Objective-C, you know, heritage, and then new frameworks that reflect a sort of Swift heritage, I think we're going to have to be dual, you know, multilingual for many, many years. And I don't know that that's such a healthy condition to have. I mean, you could say that we've had that with Objective-C and straight C that is used for like core foundation and all that, but that's a really minor, I mean, that's something where one clearly builds upon the other. And Swift does not build upon Objective-C or C.
Right. And obviously you can have C and Objective-C in the same file. You can also have C++, you know, and Objective-C in the same file. You cannot have Swift and Objective-C in the same file or the same class. It's impossible, right? Obviously. Yeah. It wouldn't make any sense. So, yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I love some of the stuff that Swift does is brilliant. It's just I just worry it goes a little too far in the shift. Not saying that where it ends up is bad necessarily, but it's different enough in some respects that I worry about jumping to anytime soon. But yeah, you're right. I don't know. 5 years, it's hard. It's a long time. And and certainly, like, the day Apple releases a new API that only works in Swift, if that happens, it's game over for this whole conversation. Everyone needs to immediately switch to Swift. Seriously, like, when the writing is on the wall like that, forget about it. Like, you've already missed the shift. You need to catch up.
The problem, Manton, is that that's liable to happen while there are still frameworks that you maybe have to use Objective-C with.
Well, right. Unless they come up with some way of having, is it possible that they could go back to older APIs and sort of Swiftify them?
I don't know.
I don't know.
I think maybe there's some concessions I think they could make. And let me just caveat here. I have not had a lot of experience with Swift yet, but I'm mostly speaking about this from the point of view of somebody who's played a little bit with it and then heard the complaints from other people. Mm-hmm. But one of the big things that comes up is the lack of dynamicism, the lack of being able to dynamically resolve like what message gets sent to an object, because in Swift there are no messages. Right. It's a linked language, and it seems to me, you know, obviously they have some stuff in there to facilitate linking with Objective-C and therefore calling through to stuff in Objective-C that will ultimately be dynamically messaged. And maybe there's some concession they can make where there's like a special, you know, I get that I think one of the big wins of not having that dynamic dispatch is that they can then predict with the compiler exactly which objects, which instances, or not instances, which classes of object will be messaged.
Yeah.
And then they know that they can optimize it. You know, Mike Ash had a good post about this, actually, yeah, talking about some of the ways Swift is liable to become higher performance than Objective-C. And I thought he made a good point, which was like, you know, he was pulling a high percentage out of thin air, I'm sure, but he said 99.99% of the time, Objective-C code does not need to rely upon dynamic, you know, the question of what kind of object you're messaging is not really a question in most of the code that we write. Like, we know, yeah, in fact, we want to be confident about what the class of the target is. So maybe it's enough to say, throw us a bone with Swift to let us have some kind of dynamic dispatching that we opt into in those 0.01% of cases where we want to or need to.
That would be cool. I did love that post. And at first I was a little shocked at the premise, which is that Swift could be faster, but it's not now. But of course it is a beta and you can expect things will get better. But also, I mean, it's funny because earlier when you just called Swift like a higher level language.
Yeah.
But then 5 months later you said, maybe it's not great for, you know, some, you know, maybe it's, you almost said it's almost better for like lower level things that need to be fast that we might have written before. So which is it? Like, maybe they need to just make up their mind. Like, is it for faster, high performance code, or is it for more higher level? Because you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, it's almost, I mean, Ruby is famously really slow. It's like the slowest language anyone uses today. And it's getting better and faster or not, but it's very slow. But that doesn't stop it from being hugely popular and on web servers all over the place. Because the fact is, performance for a lot of apps just doesn't matter that much.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree that there's a lot of it's hard to wrap your head around what Swift is. And I think that that's in some ways it's, you know, kudos to the language designers for not merely imitating some specific other language. You know, it's not an imitation of C or Ruby or Python or whatever these crazy academic languages they based it on. But it's an imitation of, it's a really an amalgam of features from many, many different languages, I think.
Yeah. And in a lot of cases, the better parts
of each language. Yeah, yeah. So kudos to them there, but there are all these little things where you're like, oh, okay, well, I get it. I think we're all trying to pigeonhole it a little bit. We're like, oh, okay, I get it. It's a higher level language. Like when we first saw it, it's like, oh, okay, I get it. This is like a scripting language.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, except for it's not interpreted. So it's not a scripting language. And then, you know, oh, this must be like everything that's good about Objective-C, but with new features. Oh, except for it has no dynamic dispatching. And then you start to go like, well, what the heck is this thing? And and does the fact that I have to learn an all new language with all new syntax and throw away many of my beloved habits from Objective-C, does all of that, is all of that worth it? Quote unquote, just to get like some increased memory safety and some more expressive, like closure based code.
Which I do love that part.
Yeah.
That's the thing, is some parts of the language I love.
Yep.
And just other parts kind of pulling me back. Right. For right now, I think it's a competitive advantage for me personally to ignore it and just use Objective-C and be productive.
Yep.
But I don't know. Maybe there'll be some downtime at the end of the year after it's 1.0 and I'll be able to spend a week playing with it. But right now, no. Gotta ship apps.
I agree, Manton. And it turns out even when I'm just focusing on Objective-C, it is hard enough to ship apps.
That's true.
But, you know, gotta keep working at it. So on that note, Manton, maybe we should wrap this up and get back to work.
Yep. Good talking to you this week. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the show. As always, send us feedback at feedback@corent.org or on Twitter or app.net at Corent. Tell us how wrong we are about Swift. Follow up on a future show. Leave us a review in iTunes if you want. And, of course, check out the jobs board, jobs.corent.org. Just had a couple more posts to that in the last few days. So check that out if you're looking for a great job or you need to hire a high quality, great Mac or iOS developer.
All right. Sounds good. See you next week, Manton.
Bye.